everyone. I guess we can sort of dive in. Initially, the email I sent yesterday with my PowerPoint presentation, it wasn't received. Then I texted it. That didn't go through. And so clearly that's a bad omen. Except as you'll find out in just a moment, I don't really believe in omens. So it means nothing at all other than maybe what our friend, who was next door earlier for the previous breakout, Jordan, he said technology never works. And I think that's the whole case. You don't really need to read into it. I want to talk to you today about religion without superstition. And in order to do that, first, I want to just take you into sort of some remote portions of the New Testament. I'm going to read to you from a bunch of different passages from Scripture. I used PowerPoint yesterday for the first time in about 8 years, and so this is the most rudimentary, basic presentation. I think I probably included way too much text on slides, so in fact, each slide that goes up will have too many words for you to be able to even read it, but you'll sort of be able to kind of get grounded. But the first slide we can go to. Thank you. That one is intelligible. Okay, good. This past year, Sarah Beth, my wife and I, and my parents, Paul and Mary, and 25 parishioners from St. Matthew's Church in Bedford, and also a good Mockingbird friend, Stu Shelby, and then Kurt Benham, who is here, made a pilgrimage to Greece and Turkey to follow in the footsteps of St. Paul. And it was a wonderful trip. I can't recommend it highly enough. If you're a Christian and you've been to the Holy Land, your next trip should be a trip to follow the footsteps of St. Paul. It breathes life into the Scripture. It helps you to really appreciate just how amazing it is that our religion sprung and flourished in the ancient world and how that really came to be. And one of the things that I'd never really thought much about other than in passing was Paul the preacher. There is a common, I think, misconception held by a lot of Christians that while Paul was brilliant, because he was so sort of intellectually complex in his thought, and his letters require such study, and because there's also a story about a young man falling asleep when Paul was preaching once, the caricature is what? Paul was a terrible preacher. A great writer, a brilliant thinker, an inimitable leader, but a boring preacher. And if you take that trip overseas, I think you might come away thinking about him differently. I became convinced that, in fact, Paul was a brilliant preacher, an effective preacher. What teenager is not a teenager if they're not bored in church, right? The best preachers in the world bored me to tears. I remember having lunch once with John Stott as a little boy. He's a very famous person in the Christian world. All the adults were on the edge of their seat when he preached. I don't remember a word of it. I was a teenager in church. Of course a teenager fell asleep in church when Paul preached. That doesn't really reflect upon his preaching. But what we also know is that he preached all over the ancient Near East, and that he made a huge impact when he did. And he had this ability to connect with all kinds of different people in all kinds of different ways. To the Jew, I became a Jew. To the Greek, a Greek. And to the prisoner, a prisoner, right? To the merchants, a tent maker. He had this ability to connect with people. And when you stand on Mars Hill and you read the passages from Acts when he preaches there in Athens, and you think about how he was connecting with this sort of philosophical trains of thought that were so present in that world at that time. And then you go to the Philippian jail, where he so impacted the lives of those fellow prisoners. And then you go to where Lydia first encountered him. And you think about the way he was able to connect with people. And then you read this rather obscure passage that takes place in Ephesus. I think you might draw a different picture of Paul. And so I think it's not that he was charismatic. It's not that he was a great preacher in the sense that he was full of gravitas. But the message he preached was so incredibly impactful. And it made such a difference in people's thinking in all different stratified areas of life. And one of the ways we know this comes from Acts chapter 19. Before we go to that slide, though, I just want to draw attention. We went to Ephesus. Ephesus is it's sort of the Disneyland of ancient Greek ruins. And it's an amazing place to go to. And in Ephesus, it's got this famous main strip and this beautiful old library, and it's just unbelievably beautiful. And it really causes you to sort of marvel. The toilets actually were better in ancient Ephesus than they are today there, and in most of Greece, for what it's worth. But this is the stadium in Ephesus. And when I saw the size of it, I was blown away. And I was blown away because I suddenly could picture the events that happen in the 19th chapter of Acts. And all this is just sort of a setup. What I want you thinking about today is, what was this message Paul preached? And what kind of an impact was it capable of having? And hopefully you'll see why. But something you need to know about Ephesus, it was famous long before Paul went there, because Ephesus housed, or it was the home of, one of the seven wonders of the world. The Temple of Artemis was there. And so it was a famous pilgrimage spot in the pagan world. And the Temple of Artemis was full of these statues, like the one you see on the right there. And in these versions of Artemis, you sort of maybe think the goddess of fertility, if you've, you know, studied that when you were growing up. She's got all these zillions of boobs hanging down. That's what those are, all those little couplets dangling. And this image of Artemis that became known all over the ancient world was one of this incredibly fertile, multi-bosomed goddess. And in Ephesus, people would make their pilgrimage to the great Temple of Artemis, one of the seven wonders of the world. And there they would do sort of like what you might do if you went to Lourdes in France, where Christian pilgrimages in Las Vegas have sort of joined forces. You can buy incredible souvenirs, right? Well, that's what people did. You go on trips, you buy souvenirs to remember your trip by. And Ephesus had a huge booming religious trinket industry. There were famous silversmiths there, famous artisans there, and it was a pretty rich place because of the constant stream of tourists, of religious tourists coming through. And they would carve these little statuettes out of silver. You could buy bigger ones of the goddess Artemis. So now we can go to the next slide, and I'm going to read to you from Acts chapter 19. I'm just going to read, well, a little bit. I'm not going to read all of what you see up on the screen. But listen to this story, and you can see there is just an ancient little statuette of Artemis, the kind of thing people would go there to buy. This is what we read. About that time, there arose a great disturbance about the way. That's the early Christians. A silversmith named Demetrius, who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought in a lot of business for the craftsmen there. He called them together along with the workers in related trades, and he said, "You know, my friends, that we receive a good income from this business. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people here in Ephesus and in practically the whole province of Asia. He says that gods made by human hands are no gods at all. There is danger not only that our trade will lose its good name, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis will be discredited. And the goddess herself, who is worshipped throughout the province of Asia and the world, will be robbed of her divine majesty." So in other words, he would preach a message that would take away the power of this goddess in people's minds and hearts and lives. It goes on to say, when they heard this, they were furious and they began shouting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Soon the whole city was in an uproar. The people seized Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, and all of them rushed into the theater. That's that stadium I showed you the picture of earlier. Paul wanted to appear before the crowd. He wanted to preach, but the disciples would not let him. Even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Most of the people did not even know why they were there. The Jews and the crowd pushed Alexander to the front, and they shouted instructions to him. He motioned for silence in order to make a defense before the people. But when they realized he was a Jew, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" Do you see what's going on here? The threat of Paul's preaching created a riot. People were so worried that he would have an opportunity to even just open his mouth with this message that they had heard about, that they spent 2 hours yelling him down and preventing him from being able to stand before them. And I want to now report to you, the good news is he got to preach this message in all kinds of other places. One of the great places where he preached this message successfully without being silenced happened in Corinth. Another place you can go, we had a church service there, it was incredible. So now we'll go to the next slide. From 1 Corinthians chapter 8. This is where Paul tells us some of the things he might have said to the Ephesians, although we know it would have had to do with these statues that were revered and this devotion to Artemis when it was in Ephesus. In Corinth, there was a slightly different issue that was a factor in much of the ancient world. It had to do with meat sacrificed to idols. And I'm going to read starting at verse 4. "So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, and indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live. And there is but one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live. But not everyone possesses this knowledge. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat sacrificial food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to a god. And since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your rights does not become a stumbling block for the weak." You may know this, but ancient Greek religion revolved around animal sacrifice. They would bleed animals out and then burn the carcasses in the temple. The meat would be taken off of the fire before it had fully cooked, and then it was sold in the marketplace, often right outside of a temple. You've heard of farm to table? Well, this was temple to table. And early Christians, new to the faith, did not want to be complicit in religious practices that they did not believe in any longer. They understandably had questions about whether or not it was okay to eat meat that had been consecrated in a Greco-Roman temple and that had association with non-Christian deities. Behind that question was an even bigger question. Might eating food sacrificed to false idols, to false gods, jeopardize the Christian's good standing with Christ. All that to say, pagan Corinthian culture was very superstitious. Maybe you're familiar with another ancient religious Greek practice called augury. Augury is the word used for the interpretation of signs and specifically birds. There were priests who would stand in a temple and they would watch birds flying in the sky, and they would interpret based upon what they saw whether or not it was a good time to buy a house or whether or not it was a good time to try to have children or whether it was a good time to try to pass a new law in the Senate. You may remember in the ancient legend about the founding of Rome with Romulus and Remus that the two brothers go out and they're conflicted and they wait to see birds, and one of them sees 13 birds and the other sees 6 birds. Do you remember all of that? Anyway, trying to interpret the birds of the sky or by slicing open the bird and watching the entrails fall open in a certain way, almost like herbs in the bottom of a teacup, depending on how the intestine fell, one could draw certain conclusions about luck and about fortune and about how best to make a decision. They believed, in other words, that certain actions could help or harm their relationship with the gods. And this kind of thinking and spiritual culture bled heavily into the earliest churches. Now, we may think of ourselves here today at the Mockingbird Conference in New York City as being a million miles and years removed from the ancient world. But I think there are still plenty of parallels to modern day life and thought. Maybe you've heard of the baseball player Wade Boggs. He had a nickname, which was the Chicken Man. He was called the Chicken Man because he would eat chicken before every single game he played. He was convinced that would enable him to play better. And so Wade Boggs became known as the Chicken Man, and athletes are notorious for this kind of thinking. They won't change their jock strap until they suffer a defeat or some such thing. But most of us are actually not that different from Wade Boggs. I wonder if you ever think about superstition or act superstitiously in your own life. Maybe you're familiar with the saying, quid pro quo. It means something for something. It refers to a dynamic that involves, to quote the dictionary, an exchange of goods or services where one transfer is contingent upon the other. In many respects, we live in a quid pro quo world. We think very much in terms of cause and effect. In order to make a purchase, we have to pay for the item first. In order to make things happen, apparently we have to do certain things to bring those things about. It means that when we think about life, we're always thinking about the world as it relates to our performance. David Zall wrote a great book about this called Seculosity. It's actually a very subtle, even insidious, train of thought. It's one which most of us, in fact, carry through into our lives. People, in fact, often apply it not just to their life on the horizontal plane, but into their spiritual life and their thinking about spirituality. And the moment we do that, we're right back to the ancient pagan world. Think of superstition. Superstition is the way that we apply a kind of cosmic quid pro quo dynamic to our thinking about life in the cosmos. It's the religion of instinct. It's the religion that people come up with when they are presented with nothing alternative. It has to do with when we think or hope that something will happen, then we come up with certain little behaviors that we can do to keep things in check. Maybe you can do something to increase good fortune, like grow a money plant or put a cat in your window with an arm going like this for prosperity. Or maybe you can do something to mitigate bad luck, to sort of get rid of bad juju. You can buy a sage bundle and smudge around your apartment. And this, unfortunately, is how many parishioners think of clergy when we come to their house to do a house blessing. We knock on wood whenever we talk about tragedy abstractly. It's like we'll jinx ourselves in some cosmic way. We do this little gesture because we don't want the thing we're talking about to come to pass or somehow boomerang back on us. So we make sure that we don't walk under any ladders, we don't break any mirrors, we don't leave hats on the bed. If we go through a yellow light, we do this quickly. If we walk into the chapel at Sewanee, we make sure not to step on that giant gold seal. A mistake I made the first time I walked in there. There are endless other examples from contemporary life. I don't know a single person who owns a black cat. If you do, I love you. Thank you, Sam. I knew it. A brother in the gospel. I had a parishioner come up to me after I talked about some of these ideas not long ago. And she said, I am 70 years old. And when I walk down the street, I still make sure not to step on a crack because I don't want to break my mother's back. And my mother has been dead for 20 years. The truth be told, I think many people think that superstition and faith are kind of the same thing, or at least interrelated. I find this playing out all the time at social functions. When people find out what I do for a living, if they don't walk away, and sometimes they do, then they try to connect. They try to go spiritual. Invariably, they tell me about some quasi-spiritual experience that they've had, or some New Age belief that they have about envisioning the future in order to manifest it. Or that in the end, we all agree that what matters most is that you're a good person. And I would never do this in the middle of trying to connect and build a bridge with someone. But I'm always tempted to say, you know, I don't believe any of what you're saying. In fact, what you're describing is basically the opposite of the faith that I espouse. It's nice that you eat so much chicken. But that really has nothing to do with what we're trying to convey on Sunday in church. You should come sometime. Of course, I only say the last part. And Paul's point at the end of that lesson from Corinthians is don't flaunt it. Don't take away the only God a person has. Don't extinguish the flicker of fresh spiritual interest that lies within a person's heart. And that is good advice. But my point with all of you today is I want to go and talk about these things all the way among a group of like-minded people so we can think about it. We're not at the cocktail party today. The truth is that people err in the direction of superstition. New believers and old believers alike are constantly reincorporating superstitious cause and effect type thinking to their faith. And it takes grace not to be superstitious. Or rather, grace is the antidote to superstition and to thinking about spirituality. Now I'm going to read something to you. It's a little long. We can go to the next slide. I love this passage. I've always wanted to share this with people, and it's too long to read during a sermon at church. But this comes from a book written by a psychologist named William Kilpatrick called The Emperor's New Clothes. And he tells the story. He's a psychologist. Was he a psychiatrist, Dad, or a psychologist? psychologist who was a member of Grace Church just down the street on 11th and Broadway in the late 70s. And he wrote a really great book called The Emperor's New Clothes. And in it, he tells the story of going on a vacation. And he was a real Christian believer. And he finds himself sitting in this beautiful White Lotus-esque setting in the Bahamas. And he wrote this little two-page piece called The Brahmin in the Bahamas. And I think this is, in fact, the kind of logical conclusion, the end point in superstitious thinking. And while we may think we can incorporate just a little yeast into the dough of our lives, in fact, the moment we begin to go there, we open ourselves up to a leavening that finally ends in the implications that are talked about in this story. Now, he's talking in the late 70s, early 80s, but there's always a book in vogue that talks about these same ideas. At the time, it was a book called Profound Simplicity that was on the top of the self-help bestseller list. When I was in college, you may remember the Celestine Prophecy. I remember a girl gave me her copy, and it was highlighted heavily. Then you remember The Gift from a few years ago. I loved when Dave Chappelle took that one on. But this is going back to the 80s equivalent. Here's what he writes. And I'm going to read this two-page piece to you, and then I'll get back to addressing you directly. While on vacation at a resort hotel in the Bahamas, I found myself seated for lunch with a bronzed, golden-haired psychologist from Arizona, a woman friend of his, and a young couple from Massachusetts. The psychologist noticed that I was reading Profound Simplicity. Now, Profound Simplicity is an extreme, though not untypical, example of the self-help through positive thinking genre. Among the profound simplicities listed by its psychologist author are the following items. There are no accidents. Events occur because we choose them to occur. Every death is a suicide. A rape victim, in quotes, is choosing to be raped. Social minorities are oppressed only if they allow themselves to be put in a position they call oppression. That's a great book, isn't it? Offered the psychologist. I couldn't bring myself to agree with him. And so we fell to talking about psychology. He was in the business of past lives therapy and had written two or three books on the subject himself. Most of his inspiration for this had come from Hinduism and Buddhism. I asked if he thought there was anything of value in the Western tradition or in Christianity. Christianity, he explained with an amused smile, makes people feel guilty. Guilt is a crippling emotion. The others at the table nodded in assent, and the psychologist settled back comfortably in his chair. It was an open and shut case, apparently. I inquired further. Why are you attracted to the idea of reincarnation? Because, he answered, next slide, it solves the problem of suffering. All his life, he explained, he had been perplexed by the sufferings of the unfortunate and handicapped. The little girl, for instance, who was born crippled. How could such a thing be allowed in a God-governed world? The answer, he discovered, is simple. Everyone gets what he wishes for. Some people just aren't very good at wishing. The crippled girl's present suffering stemmed from her past life. She is now simply getting what she deserves for failing to make the right choices in her former reincarnation. It is, in short, her own fault. As I tried to comprehend this resolution to the problem of suffering, the man from Massachusetts began to speak. He had mentioned earlier that he was a computer scientist. Surely, I thought, in the name of science and Yankee skepticism, he would voice a dissent. But no. He offers that this is pretty much in line with his own thinking. You're totally responsible for your own life. You choose everything that happens to you, and you pretty much get what you deserve. At this point, his wife, a social worker, added that the same ideas were corroborated in something called the Seth Journals. Wait a minute, I protested, feeling faintly like Alice in Wonderland. You, addressing the psychologist, said you gave up on Christianity because it made people feel guilty. But this is the most guilt-provoking scheme I've ever heard. You're telling this crippled girl, in effect, that she has no one to blame for her handicap but herself. From one plane, you could call it guilt, he replied calmly. But it's really just a matter of responsibility. We choose what happens to us. Perhaps she should try harder this time around. People have much more choice than they think. They're just afraid to use it. By this time, I had had one or two drinks. Tropical drinks taste so sweet that I tend to swallow them right down. A haze of sunshine filtered down through the palm fingers above and settled on our table. I noticed that the blue twinkle in the psychologist's eye matched the blue water below. He was a pleasant fellow, really. The others at the table smiled benevolently at me. They were nice people, I thought. Maybe they had something there. We sat on a shaded patio, surrounded by palms, looking down at flights of terraced deck descending to the sea. The intellectual class at leisure to philosophize widely. Had I been a Brahmin all along without knowing it? We had found our place in the sun. Surely we deserved it. Let the others attend more carefully to their affairs. I love that description of thinking that you are basically in charge of your own destiny, which really lies at the heart of the superstitious project. Now, I want to contrast that train of thought, sort of writ large and fully exposed by William Kilpatrick. I want to contrast that with St. Paul, going back to the lesson from 1 Corinthians that we read a moment ago. The verse, the key verse, is verse 8, where we read, "Food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do." Can we turn now to the next slide? Let's go to the next one. Thank you. This is Paul writing, again, the same ideas, these powerful, life-changing, freedom-instilling ideas in his letter to the church at Colossae in Colossians chapter 2. He writes, "Since you died with Christ to the elemental spiritual forces of this world, why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to its rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These rules, which have to do with things that are destined to perish with use, are based on merely human commands and teaching. Such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom, with their self-imposed worship, their false humility, and their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value." The photo on the left was taken of me in January. Sarah Beth and I were walking on our way to a wedding rehearsal in Cartagena, Colombia. And I was in my full clerical get-up, getting ready for the rehearsal. You can see my prayer book in hand. And as we were walking down the street, we noticed these painters. And they were painting this door in bright turquoise. The color, it's a very colorful place. And I said, "Oh, here's a great opportunity for me to show just how much of a Christian I am." Sarah Beth had her camera, and she quickly, "I got permission from the guys. Would it be okay if I stood under your ladder for a photo? You can stay right where you're doing, just keep working, but would it be okay?" And they sort of looked at me like I was totally insane, but they agreed. And so I got to have this photo taken. This is an example of a practice I call advanced spirituality. One of the ways that I chose my current job, I serve a parish in Bedford, 40 miles north of here, called St. Matthew's. I wasn't sure if I was interested until I heard that I would become, if I got the job, the 13th rector. So then, of course, I threw my name into the hat, because as a Christian, 13 is one of my lucky numbers. They're all lucky. They all have no implications whatsoever for me in my daily life. But I'm proud to own that title as a Christian. I hope you can see how the Christian faith offers a word of peace. And when we talk about freedom, this is in fact what we're talking about. And just to make the point before I wrap things up, I'm just going to do something.
We're going to start entry level. Any of you can do this the next time you're at a Chinese restaurant. This is a have a nice day bag, and inside, what do you find at the end of the meal? Your fortune cookie. They're delicious. If you're a Christian, though, you can try this new crazy move, which is you open the cookie just as normal people do, as pagan people do, as even some Christians do. But instead of reading your fortune, you can just burn it. Right? You can just burn it. It doesn't matter. I have no idea what it said. And eat the cookie. This is freedom. My daughter is now too old for little mirrors. She has a really good one. And I found this old mirror from her childhood. And I just thought, for the heck of it, to make my point, that I might just... There we go. Just thought I'd break a mirror today. Just to sort of underscore what I'm talking about. And finally,
I am not telling you today to flaunt your freedom, but I am telling you to understand it. Because if you haven't actually understood how grace frees you from this cause and effect relationship with God, where merit can often spell one's own undoing, you will not really understand the gospel. The true God does not need to be appeased. That work was done on the cross in Calvary 2,000 years ago. His love has no conditions. Christ has removed all stipulations. He has secured for us all of the good things, the freedom from guilt, the good standing, and especially life eternal, come what may. These are the things that we hunger for most deeply in this world. And because the gospel is not based on cause and effect, we can go to God with our petitions, knowing that he will answer them, not according to our performance, but according to what is best for us. Because he loves us the way a good parent loves a child. If we could go to the next slide. I want to read to you from Dorothy Martin, who was the keynote speaker here about 9 years ago, a brilliant psychologist and therapist for many clergy in the New York and tri-state area. And Dorothy Martin wrote this brilliant book called Beyond Deserving that is an incredible meditation on what it means to think about a realm in which all earning, all cause and effect, has been pushed to the side, and where grace instead has taken its place. And she describes this in the form of parental love with the words you see in the second quote that are emboldened. She wrote, parental love, and by the way, she died just a few years ago, but it's nice to remember her. Parental love, and by extension, all mentoring love, is authentic and effectual in proportion to the degree that it transcends the commonly assumed principle of the circular exchange. That is to say, this for that. All true love is a stranger to that kind of thinking. The justice idea of reward according to what is deserved is replaced by the much more powerful force of non-contingent, compassionate alliance with the essential personhood of the other, however small that part may appear to be, against the destructive forces opposing that person's good. This is a brilliant description not just of great parenting, but especially of the way in which Christ loves us, loved people in the Bible, and loves you and me. And I hope that it makes sense now to go to the next slide, please, which is St. Paul's way of saying exactly the same thing that Dorothy Martin elucidated a moment ago, when he writes, "There is no condemnation for those who are in Jesus. I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, neither the present, nor the future, nor any powers, neither depth, nor anything else in creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord." To close, I want you to just think for a moment about what these two trains of thought really look like in practice with a story that my wife told me about a friend of hers. Just take that down. If you want to imagine I'm still holding it, that's fine. Sarah Beth has a friend who for many years lived in Texas and was very involved in the Big Brothers program that you may know, where adults are able to go and spend time working with children and mentoring them. And this friend of hers, John, spent a lot of time with one young teenager who had two older brothers who were incarcerated in a rather challenging set of circumstances, and they forged a really special friendship and kind of quasi-father-son kind of a relationship. But then John got a new job, and he had to move to Memphis. And when he got to Memphis, a few weeks into his new stint there with the rest of his family, he called this boy's mother to check in and see how he was doing. And to his dismay, she told him, he knew it was up to him. He knew he had a chance to choose otherwise, but he blew it. And so now he's in juvenile detention, and I'm not going to see him. I warned him. And that's when John got on a plane, and he flew from Memphis back to Texas, where he rented a car and drove straight to the juvenile detention center. And when he got there, he went in and he asked to see this boy. And they went back to get him and to bring him into the little visiting area. And he could hear a voice saying, "John, John," as this young man ran around the corner to see his big brother. And he said, "I knew you would come." Grace is not about what we deserve. And that is what makes it so incredibly special. If you're spending time in this world thinking that the other shoe is about to drop, or that you can do something that will ultimately jeopardize your good standing with the universe, in other words, God, please be a Christian. Remember the good news. There is no other shoe. In Jesus, there's no other shoe. It never drops. And so I want to close. Can we go back to the slide that has Colossians 2 on it with me under the ladder? Back two slides, I think. Listen to this incredible quote from Psalm 4. This is my attitude. "You mortals, how long will you dishonor my glory? How long will you worship dumb idols and run after false gods? I, as a Christian, lie down in peace. At once I fall asleep. For only you, Lord, make me dwell in safety." Amen.